I'm talking to Eddie Conroy, the South Dublin County Architect. And Eddie, I'd be interested to find out a lot of, I suppose, reasons why different designs, streetscapes and everything to associate it with the designing and putting together of houses. But where did it all start? Where are you from originally?
From Port Leash. In Leash. I was born there in 1956, and then I went to UCD in 1975, and I qualified in 1980.
Where did you go then?
Then I went to Germany for a year, and when I came back, I was working in Kildare County Council for another year. Then I went to Dunleary, what was then Dunleary Corporation, and I was there from 1982 until 1996 when I came to Tala.
And just to backtrack a little bit, your year in Germany, did you get a lot of experience when you were there?
I did, yeah. I'd worked there in factories when I was a student, and great looking for it. I still have. And so when I went, when I finished, I went there to work as an architect in Stuttgart. And I worked on school projects. And also on the beginning of the kind of thing that interests me here, which is public realm streetscape. And I worked on renovation projects in southern German towns. So I got kind of a feeling for that there.
And when you're an architect, you're picking up ideas as you go along, and I'm sure lots of things would influence an architect. What influenced you in the early days?
I suppose when I went into UCD, around third year in UCD, it broke into two kind of streams. One was what was a kind of a high art, new modernism, kind of Corbusian driven architecture, and the other one was an architecture that was about community and townscape and all the things that now interest me. And in fourth year, they used to break it in half in the second half of the year, and you'd go on a project. And I went down to Cove with a team of guys, and we worked down there for 6 weeks with the local authority down there doing housing projects and surveying old buildings and meeting community groups. And I really loved that. And it was then I decided that I'd like to go on that side of the public sector side of the architecture world, which allows you to be involved in all of that, particularly the idea of planning ahead of time, the idea of making streets, squares, this idea of civil life that interests me, the link between the built world and the civil world, the idea of a society and a place where people are welcome.
So not necessarily one-off buildings, it's just a whole block of buildings.
Yeah, really. That's right. What interests me is this idea of how the buildings come together to make a commonality. And I love towns, and I grew up in Port Leash, which was a kind of a garrison town. It's a tough old place, but it had a very strong structure, a big square at one end, a small square at the other. It was very clear. So I've always been very interested in towns and how they're made and how we can do that. And all the work, to a large extent, all the residential growth in Ireland from the 1930s has been about low-density garden suburbs. And I think, personally, I think it's very damaging to people, both socially, physically, their health, their commuting times, all the things we're all kind of more familiar with now. And I think the town is the antidote to that. The town is the place where it's lovely, where you can meet culture, where you can meet your friends, where you can go out, where you can encounter life. And more importantly for me, it's the place where you can encounter difference. And I think in nowadays, with the changing Ireland, with the new citizens, with all the different world we live in, the town is a kind of a guarantee for them of a place of equal standing. So I think that the town is the mechanism for bringing people together, for eliminating the polarized public and private, for the other, for the foreigner, for the gay, whatever it is, and you can all be brought together in one place. And for me, that place is the square, is the street, is the park, is the thing. And that's a tradition. I mean, people spend their money now going on city breaks to visit places that we haven't been able to reproduce for over 100 years here.
Now, your time in local authority outside in Hoth,
Dunleary.
What was your brief there?
Well, I started there first on very ordinary things like housing schemes in Loughlinstown, and then slowly we began to kind of target the housing schemes that they began to look at sites in the Dunleary area that weren't as well looked after, they were derelict, and we started to do these more careful infill schemes, which were smaller, and because they were infill, we were able to do them maybe a little bit more density, and because they were very particular sites between buildings or facing onto particular conditions, like onto streets or onto parks, we'd have to make the designs a bit more out of the ordinary. So we broke that pattern of the semi-detached, low-density house. And that fascinated me, how you could do buildings and houses that would contribute to existing situations.
Yeah, because when you look at at that area, you're looking at a lot of old, beautiful old Victorian buildings.
Yeah.
How did you, was that something that you found difficult or
Yeah,
found
but
it?
it was fascinating. We at the time there was an office called Horan Cotter, who did work in Dunleary. They're now Horan Kogan Ryan. They're a very large office in the city. But in those days, we used to kind of parallel each other. Right? They were doing private housing, we were doing public housing. But we're both interested in this idea: how do you sit into a Victorian seaside town? How do you make a built language that somehow doesn't scream at that? And that was richer. It was to do with the shapes of the roofs, with colours, with more traditional things, and yet quite modern. So all that time, say from about 1986 until I left, we were always doing those very careful projects. Some of them had, you can see there's three little houses we did beside the Blackrock Shopping Centre, if you go out there. And there's lots of them in the centre of Dalkey, and they're always kind of nicely, brightly coloured and very careful, but still modern. They're kind of very careful opes, very minimal, and but yet they fit in.
Yeah.
Fascinating problem.
When you look at modern architecture and compare it with old architecture, the older architecture has curves and it's softer, it's rounded. If you look at modern architecture, it's very square, it's glass, it's concrete and steel. Now, how can you make that beautiful?
Well, I think there's all sorts of different older architectures as well. I mean, architecture before offered you all sorts. It offered you tactility in the materials, volume in the sense of the heights of rooms, say in a Georgian house, light, very clear movement systems, and very normally a very clear relationship between the individual building and its setting. Either in the countryside, say for instance, like a Palladian house, like Castletown House, where it would affect all the landscape around it, or in the town in a Georgian terrace, where it would make a very clear relationship between the line of the terrace, the street, and the park beyond. So they're quite tough decisions that are made, particularly in the 18th century, when you get the peak of Irish historical architecture. If you look at the front of a Georgian building, there's very little given away there. There's stretched skin of brick, stretched skin of glass, very minimal. And the same with a modern building. What interests me in the idea of modernism is the idea that it can offer, again, that idea of glass, openness, transparency, universal access, bright colours, volume. All the things we try and do here are all about that. And to some extent, the modern building is a gesture towards modernization in Ireland as well. In a kind of a post-colonial world, I think we have to offer a view of the future. And that view of the future is inclusive, it's welcoming, it's about light and glass, and to try and break away from those segregated, small, cloistered, cellular world we used to live in. So I see that the buildings in a way as being beautiful because they offer those things to people as well, as the physical beauty.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't really until the 1950s and the Scott,
Yeah, Michael Scott, yeah.
the Scott architectural period, that we did that Ireland started to come forward, and some of the more modern buildings would it can clearly be seen. But surely, when you look at some of the work that has been carried out in Dublin, it in my eyes, it's obtrusive. It's interfering with what was there already, and I'm talking now about the ESB offices in Tarna. Yeah.
I know, I don't think anyone could stand over that. I think there was mistakes made, and I'm sure we'll continue to make mistakes here, but I think from the 60s on, there wasn't that same interest in
That's Fitzwilliam
Fitzwilliam
Street.
Street. There wasn't that same interest in conservation. So I also think that there's a strange thing happening in Dublin, which is that at the turn of the 20th century, the city was in such a terrible state up to independence that there was thousands and hundreds of thousands of people in slum conditions. That kind of Calcutta-like quality that of the back gardens of all these houses being built over, child prostitution, the Monto, all that stuff. There was a nightmarish view of a declining city. And I think there's a kind of a shockwave from that that still runs through, where the idea was that the city was somehow bad and damaged and not worthy of repair. Like our idea now that the city is beautiful and structured is a kind of relatively new one. In the 50s and 60s, people saw the city as on its knees. And from the 60s onwards, you began to see things like, say, the Beaumont Hospital, the UCD, all these bigger institutions began to retreat to the edge of the city. And the city was really just viewed as corridors for new roads. And I remember the most depressing day of my life. I went to a thing called the City in Crisis Conference in 1980. And It was in Christchurch, and at that time Christchurch was outside of town. You really, the lights began to dim when you went up that far away from Grafton Street, and there was a series of people spoke, and it seemed at that time that there was no future for Dublin, that that place was on its knees. And Gareth Fitzgerald famously had this kind of thing about it was impossible to bring public transport to Dublin, it was impossible to break the low density thing, and I came out just so depressed. But afterwards, in my own head, I just vowed that I wasn't going to let that happen if I could do anything about it. And I was involved in a campaign for Tampa Bar and for various other things that eventually came good. And the city now really is only as it is. This idea that it's lively and that people live there and you can go and for a pizza and there's farmers markets, that really only dates from about 1986. Before that, it was very difficult. I remember when the Dublin City Council built their first house on Mead Street under Jim Barrett, the ex-city architect. That was an incredible moment because that was the first time that it showed that since the end of the 19th century, it was possible to live in the city in relative comfort with children, with a garden, with all of those things. And I think the middle class began to look at those houses and think, I could do with that too. That, you know, to some extent that the regeneration of the city from the 80s onwards with the tax incentives and all that came from that moment when people could see, geez, it is possible to live in town and nice and interesting and all of that.
Were you involved in the Temple Bar project?
Not in the project itself, but in the lead up to it. At the time when they were going to turn it into the bus garage, I wrote several articles in the Times at the time and in with groups that were activists on that. So that was, and it eventually led to how he changed his mind. The one good thing he did for Dublin was to save Temple Bar, I think. If there's anyone waiting at the party gate, that would be his entry key, I think. Because that was very badly needed, and there was one thing that was done. And that, in a way, Temple Bar showed a few things. One is that by somehow taking a project outside of the normal run of things and making it special, you can actually focus attention on it. And that's something that we've done in Adamstown. You know, we'll talk about that maybe later. But the idea of Adamstown, that you take a place, make it special, and determine that that won't be the same as everywhere else. And Hottie did that with the Temple Bar properties when they set that up. And those very, and then Docklands in turn followed on from that. So those very specific projects that allow you to focus on a place, give it a particular ethos, put people in charge who are responsible only for that place, not for everywhere else in the world. It always brings results, you know. It's fantastic.
What about Wood Quay?
Wood Quay was a disaster. Wood Quay should have been done in the same way, but the corporation at the time drove that project through. It's a horrible building. The tree, they only built the tree ultimately of the five, but I don't believe, I know.
Did you know Kennedy?
I did, and I just really felt that that was a disaster for the city. And I think since then, Ronnie Tallon's new offices on it has kind of semi-rescued the situation, but the damage that was done by the other one was awful. I mean, nobody could stand over that. And it gives architects a bad name, that kind of thing, I think. When I was in college, everybody, there was a kind of a, architecture was at a very low ebb in Ireland, and people hated it because of, well, not only what people had done here in terms of things like Ballymun or the civic offices, but also by proxy to do with disastrous housing estates in the UK and all of that. And the kind of world I come from was a kind of a hard-nosed world. I had to start looking at that, taking responsibility for it, but trying to change it. And that's where it comes from. Then the new city architect, Ali Gretton, now comes from the same period, and she belongs to the same kind of world as I do, which is the endless kind of, it's not the flash of inspiration, it's just the endless tending of meetings, the grinding, debilitating world of getting into down into the rough and tumble with planners, with developers, with taking responsibility over 10, 15, 30 years for what you're actually doing and staying around to make sure it's still all right. And that's been very difficult, but that's how towns arrive out, through that kind of doggedness.
When did you come down here to South County Dublin
Came here in 1996, and I suppose I worked in Dunleary until then, and it was a difficult choice for me.
Why did you make that decision?
It was funny. When I got that job, I was quite happy in Dunleary and a very good team, and we worked on those projects I was telling you about, buildings and squares and all that, and I had kind of a nice lifestyle. I lived in Blackrock near there, and then Tallaght seemed to be this incredibly difficult place, and it's full of difficult housing, and at the time it was just a square standing up in the middle of a car park. And I met Brian Brennan, who's the county architect here, and I spoke to him, and he at the time, and he was kind of a visionary. He said, like, this place is the worst you've done, okay, and done here, but that was easy. Now you have to face into your responsibilities to a place like this. And if you're that kind of an architect and you're interested in that kind of work, then you have to come here. So I said, okay, let's do it. So I came here then, and we worked together until last year. He retired last year.
Right, yeah. And you were facing a task and a half.
A task and a half. Because to some extent, there was all sorts of difficulties about the outlying areas like North Lundalk and West Tallaght, which are very, very deprived and difficult physically because of where they are and the way they were built. And right down to things like environmental conditions. It's very windy here. So kids pushing, young girls pushing prams across these grass, wet grass, this awful world. And then in the centre of Atala, which was really an industrial estate with a huge shopping centre. But we decided at the time when I came at first that we were going to try and turn it around. And we've done a series of projects since then that are about the creation of streets, an urban pattern that you'd recognise from any town, which is to do with parks and gardens. And that's slowly coming along since then. And I think we're going to finish that out. I think you come here in 10 years' time, this is going to be a town and a nice one.
When was what was the very first major project that you got stuck into when you came here?
First thing I did here was, I'd been doing bits and pieces of housing because I was used to that, but the first big thing I did was the Civic Theatre outside. And it's not a big building, but it was an important building because they hadn't built anything themselves. This building here was done by in a public-private partnership.
This county council building.
Offices, yeah. But they're very nicely designed by Gilroy McMahon, Des McMahon. But they hadn't done any big work themselves. And I had done a couple of bigger buildings. I'd done a swimming pool in Monkstown, and I'd done the fire station in Kill Avenue, and I'd done the little heritage-y buildings. So I was more used to building. So Brian anyway said, we'll do the theatre. Will we do it ourselves or will we give it out? And I said, no, we'll do it ourselves. I said, this is the first. Because since I've been here, I've been trying to do a thing that this concept produces buildings and people out there work on them, and then there's an issue about quality and there's an issue about excellence, and they feel big that they're involved in these things, and that's how we attract good staff and how we keep them.
Was that an important project for you?
Yeah, it was, for a variety of reasons. One was that it was, up until then I'd worked with my own team over in Dunleary, and I was used to them and they were used to me, and but this is the first time I had to come here, convince other people to work, put them into a team, get things moving. And also, it's a kind of change in direction for me, style-wise. I kind of was more modern looking than the work I've been doing previously. And so I was very happy with it. And it also, in a way, when I wanted to do that first, they had a different site for it, much further over. And I kind of had to persuade the manager and the county architect at the time to bring it where it was, because it reaches out to the square. If you go outside, you'll see it's halfway to the square. And because it's halfway to the square is coming out to it now in its new extension. And the car park that's in this big giant surface car park will be taken away, and we'll build over that. And then you'll be able to come from the square out and be at the theatre and be at the new art centre and in our new square. And then up here, we're going to do squares behind and parks up here. And we'll... So that was the first building that actually became a kind of a stud in the centre of, like a nail driven into the centre of this kind of car park. And we started to tread stuff off that around. So after we did that, we were able to, we made a plan called Tala 2000, really kind of based on the idea that. And Tala 2000 took all the sites we own and started showing buildings on them, on streets, not just sitting in the middle of a car park. And we did that with the planning department, with Daryl Larkin. And afterwards, we got permission from the Department of Finance for them to be tax incentive zones. And we had what was called an integrated area plan. And the integrated area plan was tied into tax incentives. And then we had a clear idea of what we wanted on it in the streets and the pattern of it. And that released a huge amount of energy that came just as the Celtic Tiger kind of ramped up. So between, say, about 1990, and now we've built something like 3,000 new homes here, all the things you see all around, the new shops, the streets, and we're going to build another 6,000 or 7,000 in the next 10 years. So it's becoming like a fully fledged town with people in it, with places to go, with choice, which I
but I can see, Eddie, your working office here is completely covered in papers, hence all the rattling of papers. But it shows that there's so much work going on here that you're daily dealing with new work all the time,
yeah,
coming up. And but staying on the line of how Tala grew, Did you have an overall plan, or was it just something that you took block by block and you built as you went along?
At the start, we had a kind of a general idea, and we went block by block. But from around 3 or 4 years ago, we actually made an idea about it as a town. And it was a very simple idea that we'd take what was the park on the south part under the Walsh Park, and we'd join it up along a kind of a pedestrian strip with a necklace, what we described as a necklace of spaces along it. And then we'd join them back by strong pedestrian and cycle strips into the old village. And that's a very simple idea. There's a kind of a straight north-south route, and then there's east-west routes. And then the traffic circulates around them. So the first of the east-west routes are finished now, back down into the old town, and the north-south route, about a quarter of it is done. And we'll build that out eventually. So all towns generally have a very simple idea, but you move to a marketplace, or you move to look over a view, or to be moved down beside a river on a quay. So we didn't have any of that here. But what we did have was two things. One was the view of the mountains, which is beautiful and which is omnipresent when you're here at different times of the year. So we wanted to make a space that looked out on the mountains. We haven't done that yet, but we will. And then the other thing was that we had an old town and a new town, and we thought that there was some energy between the two of those, and we joined them up, and that as people move between them, that would create the energy of the town. And we have done that. That's actually there now. We put the farmers market on one of those routes recently. It was an enormous success, because people like going between the two, and they like the farmers market. So it's the first time that in a kind of a suburban setting, you get a kind of an urban intensity, a fun of being in a town.
Yeah. What about streetscapes? And I mean, is there any view to the possibility of maybe recreating or even changing some of what had been done that was so desperate in the past?
Yeah, we've tried to do that. In the newer housing schemes we've done, we try and take small villages in the centre of these and reinforce them by adding in, say, community buildings or little enterprise centres or creches and things, and then increasing the number of people that live in them. Again, by sometimes we put in little apartment towers, or we put in groups of houses. And each time with those, we want to intensify them and diversify them. They're the two kind of thrusts of what we're trying to do. Intensify by putting more people and uses in, and diversify by trying to break this pattern of the semi-detached house or the terraced house that you can have. You can have a house, you can have a house with a garden, you can have a house in an apartment, you can have a townhouse, you can have a duplex, you can live on top looking over the mountains, you can live below looking into your garden. We want to give everybody those choices. And we also don't want kids to have to travel down to Mullingar or to Gorey or wherever it is and trundle up every morning for hours in a car. We want them to live near their parents in the communities where they grew up and have accessible and affordable housing. Now, a lot of people are talking about that. But we want to do it, and that's why we're building out Tala, that's why we're building out the centre of Clondalkin, and that's why even on the edges in our lower density things, we're trying to put in those houses there for them.
But are you learning by maybe some of the mistakes that have been made?
I think so, yeah. And we make mistakes too, and no matter how hard you try, sometimes for years we were under the impression that it was all down to design, and it suited people to think that because it's an easy scapegoat. And recently we've done very, very nice schemes architecturally in, say, in Balgaddy and Clondalkin, but which are disastrous socially already because of the combinations of people who live there or because of problem families. So that game isn't over yet. You imagine that nowadays if you do something and people move in, that all that old stuff is finished, but it's not. You still have it. I mean, you saw those two poor Poles killed in Drimna over the weekend, but we have the same thing here. So we have to deal with that. And you go out and you meet them and you deal with it, and you have to try and form communities, and people have to believe that where they're living is worthwhile, and that they have to try and impose some kind of order on it. And this office here, it's not as difficult in recent years. When I came here first, it was very difficult. We used to go to meetings regularly.
Sorry, just one
second. I just took these one or two nights a week. And at that time, we were trying to build up infill housing or, you know, housing in adjoining areas. And sometimes you go along and be 50 people, really angry, you know, shouting and throwing chairs around and rushing the top table. And I remember one night I was in Clondalkin, and we were I had a new car. When I got the new job, I bought a new car, and I brought it out to Quarryvale, which was probably the worst estate we had. And I went inside, and we were in having this meeting, and suddenly I could hear this stones hopping off the window. I was thinking, what are they doing to my car? And no one else seemed to notice. There were about 20 people at the meeting. Every now and then, it's kind of a rattle of a big stone hitting the window or hitting the roof. So eventually, anyway, when I come out, I was sure this thing was going to be in business, but it wasn't. all our attention was focused on the building. But at the time, and then another project we did out in Rossfield, we were asked to do a project out there because it was a kind of a large, I suppose what you could describe as an outdoor drug supermarket on a field. It was unbelievable. I've never now, and I've been, to be honest, I've spent my whole adult life working in council housing. I've seen some things, but this, I've never seen anything like this. And it was a house which was like a drug warehouse, and outside of it was a long wall, and kids used to sell drugs there 24 hours a day. So eventually we wanted to build housing on it to try and get rid of that, which we started to build, but they went nuts and they broke up car windscreens. One of the guys outside had a bullet put through the front of his car. Eventually we had to get the guards wouldn't come, and eventually we had to go down to them and say, well, either you're going to put foot patrols up here, or we're going to come on TV and say that this tal is now officially out of control, it can't be managed. And the superintendent was very annoyed, but ultimately he gave way and he put foot patrols up, and then we increased security on the site and we slowly built it out and we got rid of that thing. And the area up there now, it's funny because it's been drug reasonably low-key activity for about 10 years maybe, but now it's started up again. So we're facing into it again now in another area, Kilty Lawn, where again there's a big drugs presence on the street. So that never goes away, all that stuff. Despite all the kind of relative success with the building and with the community facilities and with culture and with education, but still there.
Yes, but surely your responsibility is to look at the environment, look at the way, the structure, the way the building should be.
Yeah. That's one of them. But yeah, I suppose to some extent there's, you could take the one view that I only deal with buildings, but I don't. And I suppose here we're also, as well, we believe the Architects Department is a kind of a resource for the whole organization, not just to do with buildings. Like, for instance, we're involved now in the reformatting of our website and things like the rebranding of the council through logos. At the moment I'm on a team that's working on that, and we look at things like publications and colours and things inside the building and furniture, and try and keep the whole place so that it has a very clear visual language, the council. And that's somehow to do with the manager here, the county manager, is very good. He's a visionary idea of technology is somehow enabling people and empowering people, you know. So we have programs now that show kids how to use laptops, and we have community computer training and community centres, and we also have this idea about foreign, the new Irish, but their children learning English, and you know, free English lessons for them, free computer lessons for them, to enable everybody to realise their full potential. So that's the kind of ethos of the place here, and I like that. And I kind of, we, anything we can do to contribute to that, we do. But it also means that we like the place to look like a place that does that. So when you open up our website, or when you look at our publications, they're bright and they've got colours, and our buildings are modern, and there's a kind of an overall programme of things. That's why I like that theatre I was talking about earlier on, that it's a glass box and it glows at night time, at a time when there was nothing here, only a car park. And when you come out, this thing was glowing away like a kind of lit box at night time. And I used to really love that. And the new building now outside, the arts building, is the same. It's got a glass front and it'll twinkle away there in the evening time, and it's got lovely coloured glass, and so that it's bright and it doesn't look like an office, or it doesn't look like anything else. So when you come off the Lewis, you'll see this thing glowing at night time. And I think that's the beginning of civil life, those things. The culture comes when people see these things and you think, I could be in there, I could be doing something.
What about the inspiration? I mean, who inspired you, or how do you get these ideas? And
I'm very keen on, I used to teach in Bolton Street in the School of Architecture there, and I still do in the fifth year, the final year's thesis. So I go there maybe 6 or 8 days in a year. I regularly go to the lectures in the Architects Association. I travel all the time. I go to, we have a link here as well with the new Bauhaus School in Weimar. We take students from there here, and we send people to conferences there, which is a very strong link for us because it's very modern and it's very forward looking about urban design, and we're one of their partners now. So that's how we keep in touch with that European kind of thing. And then we enter for competitions, we send in things, so we and again, that's partly a device. On the one hand, it suits me because I like it and I'm interested in it, but on the other hand, it keeps these guys here on their toes, and they like it, and they're looking at magazines and we're talking about buildings, and they're going on trips to see foreign cities, and they're involved with these Germans, and it's very, very good.
And is that good to for inspiration.
It's great for that, yeah, because then you see the most beautiful things, and you can, and then you say, well, why couldn't we do that too? That's what, you know, we're always, our great boast here is that when you look at these buildings, you should think to yourself, you wouldn't think you were in Tala. And it's a kind of a motto for our offices, you wouldn't think you were in Tala. And I'd like to think that the people here, they look to all the newer work in Europe and in the city, and it's here, and we try and do it here, and try and also as well, we commission work. So we have very nice new projects in West Tala now, and in Clondalkin, very bright young officers in town, Hasid Dukate, Sean Harrington, and they work with us as well. So it's kind of nice. My job is good now in the sense of you can do work yourself, which I can do, you can see here. You can work with your own guys, you can work with consultants, I can work with planning, and I can work with architects. So it's a very nice world for me here.
And as a team, who are you building buildings for?
We do mainly the buildings we build for ourselves, for the council, but we also offer kind of pro bono work for small groups, you know. At the moment, we're doing a building for the Childhood Development Initiative in St. Mark's, which is a government-sponsored thing to reach out to kind of kids that are at risk. Sponsored by Chuck Feeney and Atlantic, but we're doing the building for it. It's a kind of a €3 million project, but it's a very nice project, again, with places for kids to come and play and music rooms and things like that. So it's kind of, and it's very green. Mm-hmm. That's another inspiration for us, is this sustainability thing. We've just finished a big swimming pool in Clondalkin, and it's got the biggest solar panel array in Ireland, and we've got another pool out in Jobstown. It's got a combined heat and power, and we're going to start one in Lucan soon now, and it'll have geothermal energy. So each time we do a project, we try and push the boundaries of the technology as well as the architecture. Yeah. So it's quite good. I'm painting a very rosy picture. It's not all as brilliant as that.
I know. Why is the emphasis on high-rise buildings?
We don't do that many high-rise now. The tallest building in Tala is 11 stories, and those buildings out there would be 6 stories. So what we believe in, our model for the town, is that kind of European model, the Barcelona kind of model, which is medium density, very clear streets, squares and gardens, and then the 4 to 6 stories, and then every now and then an icon building that would be at a railway station or at a particular reason for it to be there. So the tallest one over there now is 11, and we put that there deliberately as a kind of a focal point. And then the rest of these building out here behind us and building in front of us won't be taller than 6. So we keep it in that kind of European. All of our thing is, on the one hand, it's quite modern. On the other hand, it's to do with a city you know already, in Lyon or in Toulouse or in, you know, all these European cities, a 4-story, 5-story city.
Yeah. Is there any attention paid to the to local tradition? As you said yourself, you're copying the European look.
Mm.
Is there any emphasis paid on Irish tradition?
Yeah, our own. No, when I say that, the European thing, it's mainly to do with buildings in the town centres. Our own housing, for instance, is traditional. It's 2 and 3 story pitched roof, courtyards, arch entrances for clear language of Alps. So when we have to fit in, or if we're building in the village now, we've done a few small careful things down there. And so yeah, we do. I mean, I suppose when I talk about the European influence, it's to do with this idea of a kind of an open, inclusive, modern language. But it tends to be more in the centre of the towns. We're a bit more careful at the level of, you know, language when we go out building in among houses, because we have to be fair to people. You don't want to put these alien objects in among them.
But is there almost a stereotype when you come to the supermarkets and you look at the Dunn stores and you look at Quinsworth and you look at Tesco and all these? They all look the same.
They do, yeah. And I think, I suppose, what at that level, what we've been trying to get away from is that idea that there's those big industrial or retail boxes. Like the ones, if you go out next door here now, we've done, there's quite an amount of retail in the adjoining one, but it's all in under apartment blocks and it's in on streets, and the bigger boxes are buried in the ground. So it was an attempt again to streetscape, doors, people moving in and out, all that liveliness. That Tesco kind of big box thing, we hate that. We've never had one of them in the time I've been here now. And we're fighting them out in Clondalkin at the moment over a similar one, because all they want to do is a big car park, big box in the middle of it. That's no use to us. We don't believe that anywhere, even right out where we don't have streets yet. There will be streets eventually, so we're not going to allow that. Mm. So I agree with you on that one. It's terrible.
As a visitor to Tala, coming in here for the first time, there's no street names. The idea of finding your way around is quite difficult.
It is. About 5 years ago, we met this, she's quite a well-known urban designer from an English office called DEGW, called Laura Nicolaou. And she was out here about another project. And after we were finished speaking, I said to her, "Oh, what do you think of Tala?" And she said it was a town that needed an access strategy. And at the time, I never thought about it. But afterwards, I began to think more and more that it was so clever that when you come here first, you don't know. Everything seems back to front. The main street seems to be the Blessington Road. And yet, everything seems to be behind the square. Everything's back to front. So all the time I've been here, I've been kind of wrestling with this idea of how do you beat that? And because, see, originally all the buildings were essentially like a campus. There were industrial buildings sitting on a big car park surrounded by a palisade fence. And they normally faced onto what were distributor roads, and the distributor roads was on a rough grid. And then as a result of which, the only thing anyone ever knew was the Belgard Road, and everything else really didn't matter because you weren't going there anyway. And really even the square, in a strange way, the Belgard Road severed the square from the old village. So you, this weird thing. I remember the first time I came here when the square opened was about 1986, and I came out coming up to Christmas and the square was rising up like a big factory ship out of a fog. It was like something out of Conrad or some incredible thing, just this glowing pyramid. And ever since then, we've been kind of fascinated by this idea of how do you name and claim the town. And even the bits we've done now are all in one corner of it because we own those sites and we released those first for the tax incentives. And we've been trying to fire up other sites around here, particularly the square. And the square was supposed to start up in 1999, a very large development which would feature the biggest public square we were going to have. And due to legal and economic reasons, that never happened. So we're still in this weird world where we've got bits of development joined up and other bits of it that aren't. And when you come as a result, it's a very strange place that there's half of it is industrial estate, half of it is a big mall, and half of it is what looks kind of like a town, except there's not enough of it. So what we've been trying to do now is up behind us, we're going to try and fire that up. We're trying to make pieces that haven't joined up yet join up. And that's what I was saying earlier on, that my earlier descriptions were probably a bit rosy. It's very, very difficult to wrestle this thing. Because what you want people to do is build in an orderly way, in a mixed use, which doesn't suit them, because they want to divide it up. They want a thing that's to do with apartments, they want a thing that's to do with retail, they want a thing that's to do with big box, or they want a thing that's to do with cinemas. When you mix them all together, it gets into a real mess for them, for everything, fire, access, ownership, noise, how you sell them, who management companies. And we've been at that now, I suppose, really at seriously at for about 7 years, about how do you get them to do that. Now, how we did it previously was through chicken, or through carrot and stick. The carrot was the tax incentives, and the stick was planning, development control. And we've done that reasonably successfully, but the carrot is gone now and the stick can only be applied when they want to do something. So at the moment now, the market is down at the moment because, as you know, the subprime banks aren't loaning, and there's been a hiccup in the residential market. So all the projects we had on the blocks here are now in irons, they've stalled. So it'll be very interesting to see how we can persuade people to start firing up again. Now that will be probably the end of next year before it comes back fully. But again, what we've done is we've used planning here to create opportunities for frontages, for linkages, and that enables people to have added value on their sites. And if they have added value, the sites are worth more, they trade the sites, to give them to people who want to develop them, and there's a market. In a strange way, all of the models we've looked at in Europe for this normally feature the fact that the city releases the land. And all German or French or Italian cities, they're the owner of the land. Now, people have leases on it. But what they do then is that, say, they have a big army barracks that they want to release, and then that becomes a renewal district, or they have an old railway station they want to release, or something like that. We don't have that. So all the things we do have to be more in the Anglo-Saxon or American model, which is you make an availability for development, which would be to do with, you could access a site that wasn't previously accessed, or you promised them more development than they should have, which kind of accounts for the slightly muscular kind of look of these. And then you let them act loose at that. And then when it's their worth their while, they do it. And then you channel them as they're doing it. You can imagine it's pretty difficult now at the best of times. But what it is, though, is that Anglo model. And to some extent, Adamstown is our best model of that yet, because it's a town of 10,000 people where there'll be 10,000 houses, where there'd be 25,000 people. It's big. It's like, it's bigger than bigger than Tralee. And it was a site, we didn't own any of the site. This is the ultimate sleight of hand, this one, that we persuaded the Erinrod to build a railway line, to build a railway station there. We persuaded the developers that they could get added value from us being involved as as a kind of a development agency, and that we'd guarantee them for 10 years they could build out and they wouldn't be appealed, but in return for which they then had to meet the plan, and as they went through they'd deliver schools and community services and all of this. So it's a kind of a Faustian pact which has worked, and right down to now they're continuing to build that out, they're continuing to do all the work on it, although the market's down. So we haven't been able to do that here. That's called a special development zone. But in Tallinn we have a master plan, and the master plan allows, for instance, us to give bonuses to developers if they do something like a school, or if they generate a public park, or if they generate a square. So there's the carrot is returned in that form of development quantum that they can have. So it's quite interesting. But to come back to your question, it'll take 10 or 15 years before you'll be able to walk here down a coherent set of streets named and that you'll be able to understand. But it'll be there, and it wouldn't have been there otherwise. So I think it's worth it.
And just to explain to me now, how do you see Tala in the future?
I think in the future it's going to be, it's linked into the city under Lewis. And I think it's going to be a busy destination from town in the way that it'll have like some facilities that people might be worth coming out to see, like the New Arts Building has a very large gallery in it that might be worth people's while. That there'll be things that happen here that may not happen in town to do with, say, dance groups or cultural activity. I think that because it's on the loose and it's only 40 minutes, I think there'll be other reasons to come, like walking up into the mountains. And afterwards you can come and have a pizza or go for a beer, stuff you can't do now because it's very limited. And I think a lot of people that live here, I think there's 80,000 people here already within 10 minutes, 50 minutes walk. And I think in the centre of the town in about 10 years, you'll have about another 15,000. And that'll mean that the town is busy and there'll be places to go at night time. And it'll be is a busy middle-sized town in the shadow of the mountains and easily accessible for the city. Now, it'll never be more than that. It's never going to be Venice. it's not going to be this fantastic thing. But if people could live here in a normal way with their children and walking to school and cycling into the mountains and visiting a pizza house in the evenings or taking their girlfriend to the theatre and having a normal urban life and not driving down 80 or 100 miles and exhausted and taking children out of a crash and all that. Well, that's what we're interested in, that ultimately people can have a life here and a decent life.
And finally, the non-nationalists coming in here,
yeah,
is that making a big difference, do you think?
So far, it is, yeah. We it hasn't impacted that much in Tala. We see, for instance, on all the building sites now are all Poles. And in fact, they've improved the quality of construction no end. Particularly carpenters and plasterers, and it's fantastic. The place it's impacted on us most isn't Tala itself, but in Adamstown, where there's a very high proportion of foreign new nationals have bought houses there. And the reason they bought them is they're not married to the same idea we are about the semi-detached house or the bungalow or anything like that. They see advantage there. It's on the train. They have a choice of units. The district centre will be there soon. And they're buying in their droves because they're more used to living in a town. They're more urban than we are. So I'm hoping now that as this place goes on, that'll kick in as well. People will see advantage in it and come here. We made a lot of objection at the start about from people around here about building apartments because the apartment was a synonym for the foreigner or the other. And that's still the case. And when we were doing this current plan here, there was a lot of objection because the apartments were seen as heralding a kind of an invasion of these of these poor people. That hasn't materialised, and the ones that are here are perfectly well integrated. And in fact, if you go down to the library there, you can see them. It's fantastic. And I was at my niece's, was making a confession last night out in Blanchardstown. I was out, and half the chairmen were black. It was beautiful. It was great to see them all together there, playing the tin whistle and singing their songs, you know. So I personally think it's great news. And as it's gone on, we've had no episodes here, and there's very little about it now. It's, in fact, the steam seems to be gone out of it. I hope so anyway, but we have a very large number of foreign nationals on our books now for the affordable houses. They really are very keen on that. and also on the list for the houses. So,
well, there was always a tradition of owning one's own house.
Yeah, and they're very keen on that here. It's fantastic, and it's been successful for them. So yeah, I had this thing, and I'm kind of going to say it again now, but I have a feeling that for these people to belong, if you think of the world we had before, that kind of cul-de-sac world, you know, it's full of fear, and it's full of you're not joining up with us, and we're this, and you're not that, and the kind of fear of the other. I mean, when I came here first, people would object to a three-story house, you know, on the basis that it didn't fit in, you know, and it wasn't just a three-story house, it was the idea that the other would come, the other would be the single mother, the whatever it was, the foreign national, and it really, this pattern, this endless repeated pattern, it's in all country towns now the same. It's a kind of it's a strangely stultifying and damaging prospect, I think, because it doesn't allow people to walk anywhere. The kids then, as a result, are unhealthy. You see it, even in country towns now, everybody has to be in a car. You can't walk to the school. We did studies in a place in Lucan where an estate was so deep that some of the people at the back were 1.6 kilometres from the entrance of the estate, which meant if you walked to the entrance of the estate and back, it was a 3.2 kilometre walk, which meant you could never take a child for a walk, or you could never walk to the school, you could never go to the shops, you couldn't cycle. All the things that kind of bring pleasure into your life can't be done. And yet people will defend those estates to the death, you know, this kind of two-story, semi-detached, low-density world. And but I think it's brought not only fear and a certain social meanness that you see when you attend meetings regularly, these people, you know, that they just really can't get their mind around things. Whereas I think this other world, the town world, the middle density world, the public transport world, is much more open, much more what we need to be doing in the future, you know.
Yeah.
So for me, it's a kind of a social, it has a social imperative as well as a physical one, you know.
Well, Eddie Conroy, it's been some story, I'll tell you. Yes, indeed, yeah. And I wish you well in your future, and I'm sure that Tala is going to benefit greatly from your work. Thank you.
Thank you.